If two brothers are living together, it is a fortnight. You know the word. It is 2 weeks since we read this text, and at that time, we devoted a lot of our time to reading two related texts. So now we're going to get back into this particular passage. So let's read it again. If two brothers are living together on the same property and one of them dies without a son, his widow may not be married to anyone from outside the family. Instead, her husband's brother should marry her and have intercourse with her to fulfill the duties of a brother-in-law. The first son she bears to him will be considered the son of the dead brother, so that his name will not be forgotten in Israel. But if the man refuses to marry his brother's widow, she must go to the town gate and say to the elders assembled there, "My husband's brother refuses to preserve his brother's name in Israel. He refuses to fulfill the duties of a brother-in-law by marrying me." The elders of the town will then summon him and talk with him. If he still refuses and says, "I don't want to marry her," the widow must walk over to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal from his foot, and spit in his face. Then she must declare, "This is what happens to a man who refuses to provide his brother with children." Ever afterward in Israel, his family will be referred to as the family of the man whose sandal was pulled off. Well, let's look at this too. Righteousness in the face of shameful male behavior. I put it that way because that two verses that follow, verses 11 and 12, are about shameful female behavior. But notice, again, do we know the word androcentric? How the scriptures tend to be focused on men rather than women? It has five or six verses devoted to male shameful behavior, and then two verses to female shameful behavior. So if you want to talk about balance, this is it's more serious for what men do. So let's look at the principal case, the problem. If you have your notes with you, we'll go through these notes. The problem here in the principal case is actually quite simple. Two brothers live together and one of them is married. We don't know if they're both married, but one of them is certainly married, and his wife dies before she has children. She bears children for the family. What do you do? And of course, here's this text offers a solution. The solution to this problem is a levirate marriage. This is what we call a levirate marriage. Notice the prohibition. This is in chapter 25. When brothers live together, one of them dies, has no son. The wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. And of course, the point here is that we've got to preserve the family line. And if she marries a strange man, he's not from the family, and you don't marry him. Then what do? Here is the prescription. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as a wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out in Israel. Well, just as an illustration, I mean, I come from a large family, and if I had died before we had children, it would have been the duty of my male relative to marry my wife. And when she had children, the first of those children, while genetically his, would be legally mine, carrying on my line. The problem here, the purpose of it is to preserve the family tree. Now, I've got a hypothetical family tree, Jacob's family tree, in which you've got all of these branches with Reuben and Simeon and Benjamin and Dan and Judah and Naphtali. Oh, Perez. I've already got Perez here. He's a son of Judah, so he's up that branch. Joseph, and then I've got Ephraim. He's a son of Joseph here. There were others. But Asher and Gad and Levi and Zebulun, you want them all preserved, not only in the record, but in the family line. This tree has to be a healthy tree. Here's what happens when you cut off a branch. Somebody's missing. And of course, I give you the illustration here of the Benjamites missing. See, there's Benjamin. We'll take Benjamin out of there, which is what happened at the end of the book of Judges. You remember that story? The Benjamites are defending the Sodomites. And so civil war breaks out, and they wipe out the tribe of Benjamin. They think they've wiped it out. In fact, the curse, the oath that they said is anybody who doesn't get involved in wiping out the Benjamites is to be cursed. And so it dawns on them when you get to chapter 1, oops, what have we just done? We've just wiped out a branch of this family tree. And so chapter 21, 6, the Israelites felt sorry for their brother Benjamin and said, today one of the tribes of Israel has been cut off, which is the worst curse anyone could experience. You see, it was always thought that you live on in your children. That's eternal life. And that's why the psalmist, blessed is the man who has his quiver full. My father had a full quiver. 15 of us. 13 survived. You know, that I suppose that still quite full, relatively speaking. Pun intended. There are several references that allude to this problem. Saul says to David, swear to me therefore by the Lord that you will not cut off my offspring for after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house. So the two worst curses are, may your seed perish and your name be forgotten. You live on in memory and in your children. But you do live on. That's Saul to David. Here's a widow's complaint in 2 Samuel 14:7. Now the rest of the family is demanding, let us have your son. We will execute him for murdering his brother. He doesn't deserve to inherit his family's property. The widow says, they want to extinguish the only coal I have left, and my husband's name and family will disappear from the face of the earth. That's the last thing you want to happen. And so that's the issue that we've got here. The integrity of the family tree is at issue. You want to maintain the survival. In the book of Ruth, it's not just the family tree, but it's also the estate, which is as a fundamental part of this picture. That's the principle, the prohibition, and the requirement, and the rationale. Any questions on that one so far? Before we go to the corollary case, and this is the one that's really interesting. Those of you who've been with us for a while notice that Moses, as an instructor, he's very effective. He always gives us the norm first, and then he talks about a deviation from the norm as the corollary case. And there's where the interesting stuff really shows up. But I'm afraid that's going to have to wait.